Most of you will know Mark and Kerry Thomas. And one of the reasons, well, the main reason that I invited them to be part of this is because the first book that we're going to be looking at is by Richard Rohr. And both of them have spent considerable time with Richard Rohr in Albuquerque, and Kerry has studied quite extensively with him, so I understand. They're both here, which is wonderful, and we shall benefit from their combined wisdom and understanding. Mark or Kerry, would you like to just briefly say a few words about this book, Falling Upwards, and what you understand it to be about in broad terms before we kick off?
Yeah, well, if I just make a start, I mean, I think there's a number of strong themes which come through. He talks about the two halves of life, but I don't think we should understand those in chronological terms, because those of us, we all get to the second half of life, which he calls the different stages of our life. But it is about a journey. And an outward journey and an inward journey. And I suppose the second half of life is about listening to the inner voice, the sort of inner restlessness that I've certainly felt within me for a very long time, a sort of homesickness. He uses the image of Odysseus, who left home but then returned home. And he talks about the first half of life in which that home is firmly established, and the security of the home and your upbringing and all the things you get from your parents and your family background. But then the necessity of leaving home and actually discovering who you really are. And then in the second half of life, learning about that inner voice more through your weaknesses and your failings than through your successes. And I suppose that's a connection with the second theme, really, what we might call the spirituality of imperfection. And Ness and Jeremy and I had a very good talk this morning from Brother Jonathan at the team meeting. He was talking about woundedness. And I suppose it's quite timely that we should have this group, because we're just coming out of lockdown. It's been a very difficult time for people, all sorts of loneliness and stuff, which we're all experienced in different ways. But the reassuring message of this book, I think, is that we learn more through being open about our vulnerability, or being open about our woundedness, about open about our failings. That's how we really do discover who we really are. And we discover the bigger reality beyond the small reality, which is our own ego, our own small self. And I think if church stops being about discovering more about that bigger reality, then we should abandon it. Simple as that, really. It's got to be about that bigger reality. And we learn about that bigger reality through our weaknesses and our failings, really, and touching them.
An excellent potted summary. I suppose it is interesting in that one tends to think that the second half of life is chronologically the second half of life, as it were, and when does this start? Is it at 60? Is it at 50 or whatever? But what I certainly pick up from him here is, and as many of us will probably have experienced personally, this is not a specifically age-related thing, is it? It's more of a conception of the way in which we look at our lives and the way in and the things that are important in the different phases of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he talked a lot about actually paying attention to reality. I mean, both Kerry and I would say that we learned a lot about the second half of life in our 20s. In very different ways, through actually the reality of what happened to us in our life. You know, I'm very grateful for the upbringing I had and the security that provided. I'm the eldest son, and that incorporated a very firm expectation of what I was going to be and become. And I'm very grateful for all that. But actually discovering about who I really was necessitated me leaving home. In my case, that took the shape of ordination, but that's just a particular thing, which was in my 20s. So I would say I started experiencing the second half of life perhaps in my 20s, but I don't know what Kerry would like to say.
Yeah, well, I was very attracted to, we first came across Richard Rohr about 15, 16 years ago at Greenbelt. And well, we went to a tent where he'd been speaking. A lot of people were coming out saying, wow, that was amazing. Never heard anything like it. And we thought, oh, who is this person? So we went to the next one and then I got the recording of that first one. And he is mind-blowingly amazing. We just got hooked and we got the regular emails. And then I did the Living School, which is a 2-year thing, and went there 4 times and sat at his feet and got to hear him a lot and others. And I suppose this book, there are lots of the themes. It's 10 years old, 2011. And it's appealing. A lot of people like this book because it's... talking about that, not in chronological terms, but actually it's quite good to have books that value wisdom and the good things that come from getting older. But it isn't actually just that. It's more, I think the underlying theme in so much of what he said, and there are several underlying themes, but a big one for me became the contemplative gaze is another way of looking at it. The way of seeing, you see things not as they are, but as you are. And the way of, and he talks later on about, well, we talked about respect, a second glance and re-looking. So it's a different way of looking. And actually children, you know, can look that way. You know, children have such a wonderful closeness with God many times, we find with our grandchildren. So we must ditch the chronological thing, but see it a bit as, well, like another pair of glasses. If we see the world with a different pair of glasses, and what he's encouraging is, we'll always go back and forth between these, well, later on he talks about true self and false self and big self and small self. He doesn't like that so much, but true self and small false self is a really good theme to pick up on later, probably, Francis, we're going to do that. We all dip in and out of it all day, and it's just this sort of rootedness in the wider scape, the reframing. He talks about transrational, doesn't he? Just one thing that's also a common theme that might be worth just discussing, because it puzzles people, it puzzled me a bit as well. But the very early on in the Living School, he talks about we prefer to talk about it as both and, but he calls it non-dual thinking. And that's all the way through. It's this book, it's lots of books, but they very much emphasizes that. And once you start understanding a bit more about what he's getting at, it's very interesting. I remember being fascinated because everywhere you see in our media and our press and our reading, even in ourselves, we see this binary way of looking at things, good, bad, black, white, big, small. You know, you're defined, you push people to opposites. We've got identical twins and we're very aware of that. You can't say, oh, well done, because that's automatically saying, oh, not so well done to the other one. You know, you push people. We've had dilemmas bringing them up and still do sometimes. But there's so much binariness in our thinking and our world, the world out there, that we've absorbed it sometimes. And we tend to think in those black and white terms. And they're saying much more that it's both and that's a big message that comes through. And maybe in this discussion about falling upwards, you know, the non-dual thinking means we're trying to speak from a wider source, stand on a firmer ground, live from a bigger perspective. I remember trying to give up but for Lent, because but was a word that always says, oh, very good, but, and then nothing, a bit of an opposite. It's quite hard to give up but for Lent, but then...
Other than chocolate, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, well, I tried that for a short time too. But no, just the opposition that we often put ourselves... Oh, permission to record.
Sorry.
Oh. we tend to find us, especially... I won't go on about it, but I find it very interesting, the neuroscience of this, that we go into the reptilian brain, the reacting brain. And what a lot of this book is talking about is going from the reactive to the responsive, which takes a wider gaze. And
the responsive,
the lizard brain, the more, when we're under stress, fight, fright, flight, you know, when we're pressurized, we go back into that binariness. So So that's a theme that'll keep coming up. It'd be interesting to hear people's experience of that as well. But that's it's a wonderful.
I think what we'll do is pick up on some of those things as we go through, if that's all right, so that we don't sort of dump too much on everybody at once. Can we sort of
yes,
maybe pick up some of these things in sequence? Because, I mean, I think that the non-binary nature of thinking and approaching things that stimulate us is really important, but I'd like to come back to it. I think one of the things before, in a way, we can consider the second half of life, we sort of have to understand what we mean by the first half of life. And I'm not sure whether everybody here will have necessarily read all the book or get necessarily what we mean by the first half of life. And I think, at least to me, I don't know how it relates to you two, is it seems to be the more formal identity building, family building, ego building, defense building part of one's life, where you are sort of building a castle, something within which to stand. Richard Rohr likens it to a container or something of that nature. You're building the container, you're building the house in the first half of life. And there is a danger, I think, in thinking that, especially since so much value is placed on the second half of life in this book, that the first half is somehow wrong or not necessary or what have you. But it actually has to be gone through, it seems to me. Otherwise, you haven't got anything to deconstruct or anything, any container within which to put the stuff that forms the second half. I don't know, Mark, and I will open this up to others soon, but I'm just going to stick with Mark and Kerry for now.
Yes, I mean, I liken it to being a parent. I mean, as a parent, you want your children to be secure and you want to give them a good framework. You know, initially the schooling you send them to and the food you give them and the rules you live by. And it's very important. I mean, we know as parents of five children that one of our children in particular was always trying to sort of push the boundaries, always trying to test how far she could go. And it's important that they do know that they have boundaries and that, you know, to go beyond that is wrong. Education later on, and then hopefully getting a secure job and a house and a partner, all those things you want your children to have. It's an important, and that's that, and I value that in my own background very much, that I was given that. But so I wouldn't want, in affirming the importance of the inner journey in the second half of life and breaking away from home and discovering, learning through failings and all that, in no way would I want to deny the importance of that good structure that we as parents want to give our children, and that in a way the church, with its teachings, why do we have the Ten Commandments on so many church walls? You might question why that's a good thing, but the point of having the Ten Commandments is there is that, and in a way, if I know as an incumbent, if I didn't actually preach about the Ten Commandments once a year, then all the congregation would go bonkers. You know, they would all sort of ask me why I wasn't talking about the Ten Commandments.
Right.
So it's clearly, I mean, I would, again, a question.
Sure?
These containers, these frameworks are important, and we can't manage without them. We would fall apart without them, but somehow there is a danger in believing that they are all, because so many distortions can be built into first half of life training, if you like. We get our training through our parents and our environmental upbringing, and this can lead to huge distortions in the way that we see the world and the way that we interpret the world. And I guess what he's sort of implying here is that those need, to some extent, those distortions need to fall by the wayside, or we need to learn a new way of looking. I think this is something that Kerry sort of implied earlier, is that we need a different pair of spectacles or a different pair of eyes through which to see which are less distorted, less, which are freer of biases and imperfections.
Yeah, I think he speaks a lot about this not as being binary. It isn't good, bad. It isn't that first half is bad and second half is good, because you can't have one without the other. But I think he's saying quite a few times that it isn't quite enough. There's more. You know, there's more than this structure of first half of life container that we all build up around us. And we see people who maybe haven't quite got that sense of transcendence or whatever beyond it. There's a phrase he uses a lot called that he mentioned several times about transcend and include. So transcend, say you come from a certain kind of background and it was your religious tradition to do something that has helped to form the structure, and that's generally good. I mean, might not be in every single case, but generally good. And then from there, you move on to another stage, just as, you know, you start to crawl and you start to walk and ride a bike and run. And, you know, you transcend and include. So it's everything that people have got to at the sort of pinnacle of being in their true self and very spiritually mature would be built on the background of all the other things that we've learnt. So the half bit always used to get me, Francis, and you're saying that a bit, you know, first half, second half. It's almost as if there has to be a half. Why do we say half? So I think it's almost, you know, there's a part of us. I always think the half bit can be distracting. And, and that's like true self, false self, or that part of us that is both infantile and also mature.
Can I also say that I think, I said I'm grateful for the first half of life, but lots of people don't have a very good first half of, you know, don't have a very, very good upbringing. I mean, don't have a very good parental background. And I think the reassuring, the hope that always the Christian faith offers, and certainly this book offers, is actually that that isn't determinative of the rest of our lives.
And I think that's really important, because there is some idea here that the true self exists before everything, that somehow it inheres in us, and that we our job is to discover it, really, to reveal what all these sorts of barriers are somehow preventing us from finding. So it's not a job of creating it, it's a job of discovering it, really.
Can I just read Richard, not really, I thought I'd marked it. Here we are. Can I just read William Wordsworth's poem, which he quotes in here? Which is exactly, some of Julia's nodding. You'll know this. This is William Wordsworth, amazingly. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, but he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he sees it in his joy. I just think I would read that at every baptism, you know, I really would. So I'm saying that's a nest down there. That's just fantastic, I think. Really trailing clouds of glory. And I think we've sometimes had it, I mustn't say sometimes, with all our children, you get a sense that they're coming from somewhere.
And it's fantastic. I mean, we've got a new grandchild, tiny little baby who seems to be a blob with means of communication, and yet within that is contained this potentially true self. The true self is nothing created, nothing we create, nothing that life creates as our journey through it goes. It's to be discovered. It is, one could broadly say, our soul, the heart of us, the thing that we are beyond name and form. And I guess that that it's interesting, many people have likened the process of getting old to becoming more childlike, and I suppose in a way we are sort of talking about a new form of innocence here, aren't we? Rediscovering a new form of innocence or naivety.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, it's a strong Buddhist concept of the beginner's mind that's emphasised quite a bit. You know, the cynicism of Well, sophistication of whether it's sort of adolescence or adult as well, but you know, that sort of cynicism that can demean things instead of seeing their pure joy, and as a child might, and we hopefully can recapture some of that. So this thing called the beginner's mind is what he asks everyone to come with, an openness, actually, an openness to being changed by experiences and what we see, and not writing things off cynically, which can be a fault of adulthood and thing, but and also birth and death are very similar, obviously, with lots of similarities, so there are some lovely analogies. That's why, yes, we were saying really the first half and second half, it isn't good to see it in that way, but it's sort of growing into the fullness of the people Christ sees in us and the Christ within us.
And, you know, now I'm retired. I mean, lots of things you have to do as a vicar, you know, and some of it's nicer than others. But the thing that continues to be, I continue to be passionate about, and I'll be passionate about it until whenever, is actually helping people discover that, exactly that, the reality of what they're meant to be growing into. That, you know, that is, I love that, that ministry, that enabling of people. And you know, we can all do that in the way we encourage and treat other people.
And I think that thing about a new naivety or rediscovering a form of naivety, in a way, helps me to understand what Jesus was saying when he said, unless you become like little children, you won't enter the kingdom of God. Mm. And it rather takes me to that, that there is a need for, you know, children are willing to pretty much accept anything or to interpret anything as being possible, aren't they? And there's this sort of, they haven't got many preconceptions about how things should be or what's right and what's wrong or what's the thing that you're supposed to believe and the thing that you're not supposed to believe and so forth. They come at everything with a form of curiosity and naivety that enables them to see things in an undistorted light, even though they haven't really got the language to deal with it yet. So I think there's something in that.
Yeah, definitely.
He talks, and we mentioned at the beginning, the whole business of this book is about falling and failing, and how the way down is the way up. I think we should talk about that for a few minutes. And to me, there is, I suppose, in this Easter season, a very obvious parallel with death and resurrection. And the idea that in every dying there follows a rising. And so, what's he saying basically about falling and failing here? We don't take to it very easily as humans, do we? Why are we so afraid of it? And what is it in it that we can? How can we find such gold in failing?
Well, I'm sorry, Kerry will tell me off, but Brother Jonathan quoted this morning from the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians. I mean, it's when I am weak, then I am strong. That is absolutely, it's such a beautifully concise way of putting it. When I am weak, then I am strong. And I know from my own personal life, you don't want, at the moment, I'm experiencing quite a lot of health issues, which I haven't, you know, this over these last 12 months, this new experience. And you don't want that stuff to happen. But I know that through that and accepting the reality of that, and obviously I'd go to the doctor and take medicines and all that and listen to Kerry sometimes because she knows a little bit about these things. Not always, but sometimes. You know, through all that stuff, I do all that stuff, of course I do, but I know the deeper reality is if I accept the reality of that, then I will experience a larger reality and I will grow into the person I'm meant to become. And I know different times in my life, lots of stuff I got wrong, jobs I've gone for which I haven't got, or whatever it is, or relationships, you know, before I met Kerry, needless to say, lots of them, you know, which went pear-shaped, you know, all that stuff, you know. And you do know that you learn so much through this. And I think also institutionally as well, as a church, when we've had a tough time, that death and resurrection. And what Richard Rohr says is that the pattern of death and resurrection, and you've just said this, Francis, really, is something we're not called to sort of put into some theory on a wall called the substitutionary theory of atonement. It's actually something we're called to follow. make real in our own lives, you know, and we do experience it in our own lives, both individually and you don't really know the truth of it until I think you experience a failure or a weakness or something yourself. And then, you know, if you allow the reality, God, to speak to you through it, that you know the truth: when I'm weak, then I am strong, of spirituality, of imperfection.
Yeah, and he talks about we learn more by doing it wrong than by doing it right, because it cracks us open. I always like that Cahil Gibran poem and saying about your pain is the breaking of the shell around your understanding. When I was widowed, it helped that because it cracks you open in a way that nothing else does. You experience and take things in a way that you couldn't otherwise do. You can't grow. Sometimes you can't grow by trying or by making sense of things with your rational mind. You grow by being exposed to something and adapting and transforming and changing with the change. I remember someone said to me, now you've joined the human race once you've felt the suffering of others, and there's a sort of collective pain. And so there, no one brings it on themselves, no one wants it. In fact, we very much try to run away from it. And those of you who might have experienced any kind of non-physical pain, like pain of loss or pain, different kinds of pains, hurt, it almost is a physical pain, isn't it, held within your heart, and yet that can crack you open and help teach you things that you wouldn't learn any other way. I've certainly been taught by things like that. So we don't seek it, and we don't see it, as you say, at the time very much, but when we look back, and we can see that it was an opening, like the door closing on a job or something, or some avenue that closes and it wasn't meant to be and something else opens. But it's more than that, really. It's how we grow, the image of the acorn and the seed and the... I just found there's a little haiku poem. I just found it now. Just a little thing. Last night my little hut burnt to the ground. Tonight I see the moon.
Yes,
yes. It's just quite a nice sort of flipping.
That's typical haiku, isn't it?
Yes. It's just a sort of flipping of what we think to be bad into,
And he's almost suggesting that almost unless this happens, you don't stand a chance of getting to a different sort of understanding or a new way of looking. He's almost suggesting that it has to happen.
Yes.
In order for us to move forward in a way that, unless it happens, we don't stand a chance.